This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 305 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Well, Max, it's kind of fitting that we're recording on October 31st, All Hallows Eve, or otherwise known as Halloween, because we're back from the living. It's been a while since you and I have met on a Thursday night and talked drones.
That's right. We had a little bit of a hiatus. It was actually kind of a little bit longer than I thought it would be, but we each had some personal things to deal with, and we've got those taken care of. So we're back in the saddle, David.
Yeah, we're not really that lazy, but it was a good respite necessary for both of us. So, but we've got a lot of news this evening. We've got the U.S. government grounding a whole fleet of UASs. Operations over federal facilities have been broadened. The Mavic Mini, Uber Eats, otherwise known as a TIE fighter, resupply or package delivery by drone, but an unusual one, to a submarine. Rethinking drone usage and maintenance at Edmonton Airport. So we've got a full show. Should we get started, Max?
David, let's get started.
Well, our first story comes from the BBC. Entire drone fleet grounded by U.S. government agency. The Department of Interior has grounded drones made in China or that use Chinese parts, which sort of narrows the scope of what drones they can operate, doesn't it?
It would seem to pretty significantly. Of course, the agency, the Department of Interior, is concerned that drones could be transmitting images and video back to China about things like key installations that the department uses the drones to inspect. And so because of this concern, they've instituted this ban. Now, they're undertaking a security investigation, they say, and depending on what that yields, we might see this ban be lifted, but it will be quite an interesting thing to observe this investigation. I'm not sure how detailed, how expansive, or how quickly they plan to undertake this investigation.
We have mentioned in the past that the Department of Interior actually has a sizable fleet of UASs of various sizes that they use things for inspecting dams or land monitor, environmental damage, endangered species, emergency workers, wildlife floods, and natural disasters. A lot of which they've got from the Pentagon and surplus. So I'm sure there's a lot of phantoms in this, as in DJI. So it'll be interesting to see, like you said, Max, how long they stay grounded. The technology challenges right now in our sort of global battle here in the States versus China in global trade war and usurping trademarks, etc. It'll be interesting to see if this is really a political repercussion or a necessity. We know that the Pentagon has said that people are not to be flying DJI products over U.S. installations for this exact reason, that they were feeding information back to China. Now, in all fairness, DJI has denied all of that, but we'll have to keep following up. I have a feeling that this is going to be an ongoing struggle for the U.S. government and overseas.
And you mentioned Department of Defense restrictions on using drones, using DJI drones. We know the U.S. Army has instituted a ban. That was quite some time ago. But we also see here that the FAA has expanded the restrictions at even more facilities.
Yeah. Now, basically, these are no-fly zones. And originally, it was military bases, nuclear reactors, sensitive insulation. But now they've gone even further. And we'll have links to the show notes. But you definitely need to check your before you fly, because they are expanding. But you should not want to fly over a nuclear reactor or a prison or some of these facilities. There are definite reasons why you wouldn't want to. You shouldn't do that.
That's right. And here we see that there's a notice to airmen, NOTAM out, that identifies more than 60 additional facilities that are restricted now. And like you say, David, we'll have a link in the show notes to the NOTAM. But there are some other resources as well. There's something called the UAS Data Delivery System that I think we might have talked about in the past. But that has not only a list of restrictions, they're called National Security UAS Flight Restrictions, but they also have a kind of a handy map of UAS data, they call it, that gives you a graphic representation of where these restricted facilities are. And of course, all of these, including the new ones, will be in the FAA's Before You Fly app. So that's probably the easiest resource to use to make sure you're not flying someplace where you shouldn't be.
And if you practice common sense, you won't have any of the problems. And we've been preaching that since the very early parts of this episode. You know, common sense prevails. But you might want to fly a new drone that's designed to be unregulated, which I think is kind of an interesting tact. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, this is, I think, a brilliant move on the part of DJI. The Verge has this piece. The Mavic Mini is DJI's first drone that doesn't need FAA registration. And this thing is pretty small. It's tiny. In fact, it's the smallest and lightest drone that DJI has ever made. And it weighs 249 grams. Now, of course, the threshold for a drone size in the U.S. that requires FAA registration is 250 grams. So this is one little gram under that, so registration's not required. I think that's cutting it kind of close myself, David. I might have gone for a few more grams under 250 just to be sure. But in any event, it's an interesting little drone. They call it the Everyday Flycam.
And really, it's a selfie drone. I mean, that's really what you're trying to do. It's got folding legs or folding arms with the rotors on the end of it. It's a quadcopter. It's got creative shooting modes, automatic return to home, which is kind of good. A 30-minute flight time, which, given the size of this, and you should definitely go out to the website and look at what's being produced. 30 minutes flight time battery is showing that we're really moving along on batteries.
That plus the fact that this thing is so light. So I think, you know, it'll take less power to keep this thing in the air.
And it shoots really good 1080p video and at 60 seconds per frame and 12 megapixel photos. So I know some large SLR cameras that can't do that. So it's not as sensor heavy as the other ones, but I think this is really for the consumer market, not necessarily the prosumer market.
Yeah, I think this might be something that's attractive to people who perhaps haven't bought drones yet. Maybe people that have been watching the industry develop over the years haven't yet bought one for the holidays or whatever. Maybe we're put off by the price for a lot of very capable drones. So I think DJI is coming in here at a price point that's really, you know, hard to to Knock. It's available for pre-order now. It'll ship on November 11th. And as for the pricing, $399, that will include the remote controller, one battery, and an extra set of propellers. But for $499, you can get the combo pack. And that has propeller guards that can be attached, three batteries, which is really what you need, I think, a battery charging hub, a carrying case, a controller, and three sets of extra propellers. So, you know, either way, it essentially $400 or $500 for the combo pack. I think you're getting kind of a lot for that price. I guess one of my concerns, well, several things, David. One is I want to see the reviews, because there isn't much hands-on experience with this yet. It's just too new. But I wonder how the Mavic Mini will perform in windy conditions, being so light and all. So I'm curious to see how it performs there. But otherwise, I think this sounds like it could be a nice device and a shot in the arm for DJI.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, they had moved away from the consumer market to the prosumer market and to the pro market. So I think this is a step back. It's well above the toy. You know, it's definitely, you're talking about a UAS and at a price point where you're not going to be buying it for your nephew. Or if you can't afford to buy it for your nephew, then you're making more money than I am. It's definitely, like you said, Max, it'll be interesting to see what the reviews are, especially about, I'm not as much concerned about the video and the photography. I think that's pretty much locked down. I think, but you're right, the flying characteristics, I wonder how well it flies to get the use of those cameras, etc.
I'm sure that there will be many, many reviews coming out in the not too distant future. And, you know, as always with things like this, it's usually a good idea to, well, hold off a little bit on purchase until you see the reviews and until there's some real-world experience out there. If you like being first, then absolutely go ahead and get your pre-order in. But, you know, you take some risks with that. And I think waiting for the reviews, waiting for the experience that others have to kind of accumulate a little bit might be wise, not just with this, but with, you know, any new piece of electronics.
Unless you like to, quote unquote, be on the bleeding edge.
Right.
Not the leading edge. So let's talk a little bit about drone delivery. We've got a new thing from Uber. This is from TechCrunch.com. Here's what Uber Eats delivery drones looks like. This is kind of wacky, kind of, it's a fixed wing vertical takeoff and landing vehicle that's, it's definitely unique looking compared to what we've seen in the past, with two tilt wings, which is kind of ironic that we're talking about tilting wings, considering on Monday night's show for Airplane Geeks, we talked about tilt rotors. So what do you think, Max? Kind of futuristic looking vehicle, huh?
Yeah, it does. It does look like that. It, as you say, it's got two wings with three rotors on each wing, one at the tip of each wing, and then one above and one below. And the wings, including the rotors, rotate. And so that would be, of course, for the vertical lift portion of it. And then you'd see the whole wing assembly on each side rotate forward, and you'd have your horizontal flight. The idea here is that, if you're not familiar with Uber Eats, is that you can order food online. Now, Uber doesn't plan to deliver the food to your doorstep by drone. What happens, or what will happen, what they hope will happen, in this case, for starters, is that orders would be flown to a predetermined drop-off location. And for that portion of the delivery process, Uber's Elevate cloud system would track and guide the drone. And then once it or as it approaches that drop-off location, and each delivery driver would be notified of when it will arrive and where it will arrive, and would pick up the food and deliver it to you. So it's not restaurant to doorstep. It's restaurant to a drop-off location, followed by a road trip, a vehicle with an Uber driver delivering it to you for that last mile, if you will.
And eventually what Uber's looking for is kind of like what we talked about with Mercedes and BMW. The Uber driver actually would have the vehicle land on the Uber car and then transfer the information and then complete the drive. So yeah, you're right. This is not from restaurant to doorstep, but it eliminates the issue that we've had about how do you protect someone from a rogue drone approaching their house, delivering their dinner. In this case, the Uber receiver would know how to handle the drone. So you're taking a little bit of that risk out of the drone delivery aspect.
And as for specs, Uber tells us that the maximum flight time would be 8 minutes. I don't know if that's round trip or not, but it includes loading and unloading. And the delivery range, 12 miles round trip delivery range, with a total range of 18 miles. So these are flights that are not too distant. So I guess this would be serving customers who live pretty close to the source of the food, the restaurant or the shop or whatever it is. Uber wants to start flights of this before the end of this year, 2019, and they hope to start deliveries next summer, 2020, in the San Diego area. That's targeted to be their initial location. So we'll look for first flights of this drone by the end of the year.
But let's talk about other drone delivery. In this case, the U.S. Navy. And this was from Forbes.com. First Navy submarine resupplied by commercial drone. The USS Hawaii, or SSN 776, a fast attack submarine, was 1 mile off the coast of Oahu. And a 5-pound payload was delivered to the sub. Interesting carrier onboard delivery, or COD, supplies to a submarine is unique. You're talking about a target at sea, and while in this case it was close to Oahu, having a drone do the delivery will protect some of the secrecy of the submarine.
The article points out that, particularly with the case of nuclear submarines like this one, that they spend most of their time underwater attempting to be undetected. And so surfacing for deliveries or receipt of material or personnel or whatever is something that you generally want to avoid. But when it is necessary, you especially don't want to do something that will garner any attention and make yourself visible to those you're trying to hide from. So a drone could play a role in that, or maybe a fleet of drones providing supplies. Another alternative, of course, is a helicopter. That's a greater cost, maybe more cargo capacity, certainly than a single drone, but maybe even a fleet of drones. But I don't know, David, maybe that's something that's more observable by adversaries. And so, drones might play a role here. But this was just a test delivery. And they say that the test, like you said, David, was 5 pounds, it included things like circuit boards and medical supplies and a little bit of food. But it's just been a test. And I don't know if this is something that will continue or not.
Well, interesting. We're back to medical supplies. And this is definitely, this would definitely be a use for, if they have someone who's sick aboard the ship, or let me correct it, aboard the boat, you could get supplies to them immediately, or high risk replacement circuit boards. I mean, the supplies that they were using on this flight are easily flown by a small thing, but would be really important necessities to the crew, you know, medication or circuit boards. Now, food, you know, the Navy wanted tacos and Taco Bell decided to send some tacos. I'm just joking, folks. But it is kind of the supplies that they did besides the food are really vital to the success of a ballistic submarine, and they don't have to come into port for that. And a drone would be a lot lower profile than a manned helicopter going out from a manned ship, you know, and going from there.
For sure.
So our next story is from sportsvideo.org. White paper, rethinking drone usage in live broadcasts. So Max, we're not going to be using drones. The Olympics is coming, and I was looking forward to all of that footage by drones of the various events.
Well, the author of this piece makes some interesting observations, and it comes from Ben Lin, University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications. He's a doctoral fellow, and this is not a news item. Again, it is a white paper. But what he observes is that while there was the prospect that drones would provide a lot of great footage for live sports broadcasts, that really hasn't happened. So he looks at some of the reasons why that is, and he notes things like, well, there's issues of safety for the spectators as well as safety of the athletes. He also points out that drones are noisy, and that represents or could represent a problem for many live broadcasts, either annoying the spectators or maybe even worse, annoying the athletes. Also, he points out that live sports broadcasts are produced in an environment where you never really know exactly what's going to happen. And you need to get the right shot, the right angle at the right time. And there's not the luxury of spending time doing something like launching a drone, or the drone needs to have its battery pack swapped out. So that's kind of an issue as well. And he also notes that, well, you know, drones that are suitable for this kind of work really are not cheap. The drone itself, the camera equipment, this stuff is pretty expensive. So for all those reasons, he says that drones are just not particularly well suited to the type of production that's demanded by live sports.
And it's interesting. I have Thursday Night Football on here. The footage you would get from a drone, they usually have on a football game, that sky cam, but that's wired into the stadium and has its own power source via the wires. And it flies over the stadium like a drone, and you don't have the noise. And so something like NFL football, where they've got the technology already built, that doesn't interfere with the play and doesn't interfere. It's not a necessary ideal sport for drones, but some of the spectacular footage at the Winter Olympics of, you know, the skiers, the downhill skiers, or what they suggest here is motorsports, where you can have drones covering various aspects of the course that is away from the main viewing stands. That actually, the drones won't have an effect on the motorsports because they're so loud.
That's right. And there's some other factors why the author thinks that motorsports are a good opportunity for drones. Besides the noise issue is a safety issue. There's plenty of room away from the drivers, away from the spectators, where you could fly drones, typical motorsports tracks. Also, the drivers are obviously protected from things much more dramatic than an errant drone that crashes into their car. Also, he points out that at motorsports tracks, they know how to clean up debris from a crash. So if a drone goes down, it's not going to be a situation where they don't know how to handle it. So that's an interesting thought. He concludes saying that in order for us to see more drone usage in live sports broadcasts, is there needs to be more collaboration between the broadcasters who have certain kinds of requirements and the racing leagues or the sports leagues that are producing the sporting event, so that the interests of both can be accommodated in a way that is good for everybody, including the viewers, which is really why we're talking about this to begin with. So it's just an interesting white paper. It kind of makes you think a little bit. Sometimes we get maybe overly excited about the prospect of utilizing drones in a certain application, but there can be real world impediments to that you need to think about and take into consideration. It's every good idea is not necessarily a good idea. It might just be an idea.
Well, and in all fairness, Monday Night Football or Thursday Night Football or NASCAR, what we've come to expect as viewers or Formula One, 20 years ago, we would not be getting the same thing. So we've grown accustomed to things over time, and it's a gradual change. I think the important component of this is it's not a sea change. Drones are not going to immediately take over everything in the sports world, but they probably will find their niche. I mean, I can remember how exciting it was when they suddenly put a yellow line across a football field you could tell where the first down was. Now we take that for granted, but it was a revolutionary technology. But it's taken time to accept it and the technology develop. And so I don't think this is as negative as it sounds the way we're talking about the highlights, but it definitely gives you something to think about. Maybe you're not going to see drones flying over specific sports. I don't see that the Masters in Augusta, Georgia will ever have a drone flying over it. So golf is probably out of it. But one of my favorite things about watching golf on television is at the beginning of the series, when they do those helicopter flight shots down the fairways and to show you what the thing is like. Well, that can be done by a drone a hell of a lot cheaper than a helicopter. But that's an implementation of using it to its best abilities. So drones aren't the end all be all to everything, and yes, we said that, but they have their niches.
And maybe the airport is one of those.
Isn't it ironic that we've spent so much time talking about not flying at airports, but more and more we get stories about flying at airports?
That's right.
This is from CBC.ca. Drone collects runway maintenance data at Edmonton Airport. Perfect use for a drone, but it was flown safely at Edmonton Airport.
And Edmonton International Airport is pretty good size. They have, of course, runways and taxiways and aircraft handling aprons that span around 2 million square feet. So that's a lot of territory to inspect. And we see here that drones are actually becoming a regular part of that airport's safety inspections.
Arium Analytics, which we'll provide a link to them in the show notes, has conducted about 3,000 drone flights over the airport over the past 4 years. So they are 3,000 flights over 4 years. That's a lot of flights and a lot of lessons learned. And And I would say that they've successfully integrated the UASs into the airspace around the airport.
Arium sounded familiar to me, Arium Analytics. So I looked on our website, and we did talk about them once before. The Robird, that's their robotic falcon that they were using to try to control bird populations at airports. So this is the same company. They're a Canadian UAV services provider based in Calgary. And they offer a range of services, videography, mapping, inspection, of course, and wildlife management. So they seem to be doing well, and it's great to hear that Edmonton Airport is, you know, utilizing drones, these drones from Arium, to do their inspections and to do them more effectively and efficiently than would have been the case otherwise. So great stuff.
Perfect use of a drone to cover a vast distance that's easier than, you know, you can see more above the runway than doing a runway run in a vehicle down the runway. So it's definitely an efficiency, and congratulations to them for integrating into the airspace. So it's not unusual now for them to have a drone flying. I'd love to know a little bit more of the details, how, when they fly, how they integrate, you know, what, how they work with the control tower. Is it just in the evenings or whatever? So, or low volume times. So airport integration is very important. We just tell you not to fly your drone near the airport. These are trained professionals, so do not try this at home. How's that sound?
Very good. All right. Well, I think that's it for this episode of the UAV Digest. We want to thank you for listening. Thank you for being patient with us as we had our little hiatus there, but we're back now. You can find us at the UAVdigest.com. And of course, the show notes for this episode, you can find them directly at the UAVdigest.com/305.
And of course, we never left social media. So you can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on Facebook at facebook.com/theUAVDigest. You can become part of our Slack listener team. You do that by sending us an email to feedback@theUAVDigest.com. And we're always hanging out there, if not paying attention, and talking drones as well as aircraft and other things. And of course, you can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. But most of all, we want to say thank you for listening. And this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you, and we're glad to be back.